Our next case is 13-304, the Bank of America versus George Kukta et al. For the appellant, we have Mr. King. Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd be optimistic today, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court, my name is Scott King. Seated with me today is Terry Posey. We represent Bank of America. In this mortgage foreclosure case, the defendant borrower entered in an appearance in the action, filed an answer, raised the issue of standing. A summary judgment motion was filed in which the issue of standing was directly at issue. The motion was granted. The borrower did not appeal. After the time for appeal had run, the borrower filed a 60B motion, again raising the issue of standing. The trial court overruled the motion. The Ninth District reversed. This court has a certified conflict question from the Ninth District, and that question is, in a mortgage foreclosure action, when a defendant fails to appeal from a trial court's judgment, can a lack of standing be raised as part of a motion for relief from judgment? Bank of America suggests that the court analyze that question in three different types of cases. Category one, cases where the defendant entered an appearance, raised the issue of standing, it was determined, and there was no appeal filed. Category two, the defendant enters an appearance, defends, but says nothing about the issue of standing. Category three, default judgments. I'm going to start with category one. Category one is when the defendant enters an appearance, raises the issue, it's determined, and there's no appeal filed. For that category of cases, the normal rules of res judicata apply. Res judicata applies to issues that are raised and determined. Res judicata applies to jurisdictional determinations. Res judicata applies even if it later appears that the trial court got the answer wrong.
Counsel, I guess the bottom line question I'm troubled by, and I'm going to agree with everything you've said so far. However, if the court that is entertaining motions, entertaining answers, and ruling on decisions does not have jurisdiction to consider the matter right from the beginning, how can it be considered res judicata?
Your Honor, you need to differentiate between cases where the court had no jurisdiction or authority to hear that type of dispute at all, and other cases where the court could have jurisdiction over that particular type of dispute, and the issue is whether it was erroneously invoked. For the first category, you never had subject matter jurisdiction over this type of dispute at all, a state court hearing a patent infringement action. For that category, all bets are off.
There would be a juvenile court hearing a foreclosure action.
Correct. All bets are off. Res judicata doesn't apply. However, if a trial court has jurisdiction over that category of cases, then the issue becomes, was its jurisdiction erroneously evoked? And that's the question that's subject to res judicata. In this case, common pleas courts have jurisdiction over mortgage foreclosure actions. Therefore, it only becomes a question of, was it erroneously evoked in this particular case?
Counsel, this is all coming out of Schwartzwald, is it not? Where the court said that standing is required to invoke the jurisdiction of the court.
Your Honor, the confusion and the certified conflict is coming directly out of Schwartzwald. The opinion in that case uses the phrase six different times to invoke the jurisdiction of the court, but doesn't define what's meant by the term jurisdiction. The Ninth District took it to mean subject matter jurisdiction. The Fifth, 11th, and 10th have interpreted differently. The Fifth, the 10th, and the 11th have distinguished subject matter jurisdiction from justiciability. It's the Fifth District in the Arlington and the Elliott case, which we filed as part of a supplemental filing, decided after the briefing was done, distinguished between justiciability and subject matter jurisdiction.
What was in Schwartzwald, we were talking about the standing of the plaintiff to file the case, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you would read Schwartzwald narrowly, is that your position, or what is your position on Schwartzwald?
Schwartzwald held that in order to invoke the jurisdiction to have a justiciable matter, you have to have standing. But that's not our present issue. Our present issue is if the court's jurisdiction was invoked, there was a judgment entered, and no appeal was taken from that judgment, what's the effect? Does res judicata attach? And our position, and we believe the court's position should be, that res judicata can attach, whether there's been an erroneous invocation of jurisdiction or not, is the subject for a direct appeal.
Is this case governed by Schwarzwald, in your view?
No, Your Honor, it's not. Schwarzwald raises the issue of what jurisdiction means and is justiciability part of jurisdiction and holds that it is. But this case is about res judicata.
But a party who files an action on a note has to be a holder of the note, don't they?
They're supposed to be, Your Honor.
All right.
And
so,
Schwarzwald,
so if you have a note and I sue on it, what basis does a court have to enter a judgment in my favor if the note is yours? And you said you'd give it to me, but you never did. I wouldn't have any basis to file a claim, would I?
The answer is if you're filing and trying to collaterally attack the judgment, you weren't a party to the judgment in the example that you're giving me. So you wouldn't be bound by that judgment because you're not a party to that judgment. But for the parties to the judgment, they are bound. This court actually addressed this very issue 50 years ago this month.
Counsel, before we go back 50 years, you just used the phrase supposed to be a holder of a note. Isn't that a condition precedent required to file suit?
Actually, the condition is you're supposed to be the person entitled to enforce the note, which includes a holder and somebody who has the rights of a holder. And yes, Your Honor, it's supposed to be. The issue, though, is...
Why are you using that term, supposed to be? Is it not a requirement?
The answer is it is a requirement, and had there been a direct appeal in this case from the original judgment, then we would have issues.
So this case could be controlled by Schwarzwald had there been a direct appeal.
You're absolutely, Your Honor. If there had been a direct appeal,
we don't have a Schwarzwald case because this is, in your judgment, a collateral attack on a judgment through the auspices of a 60B motion for relief from judgment.
Yes.
And so you distinguish this from Schwarzwald because it's a procedurally different factual pattern from what was presented in Schwarzwald.
That's absolutely
correct.
But
the underlying circumstances are similar.
Yes, Your Honor, that's also true.
What's the purpose of 60B?
The purpose of 60B is to set aside judgments for the limited grounds that are listed in 60B. It's supposed to correct errors that were not and could not be the subject of a direct appeal. This issue could have been corrected on a direct appeal, but simply was not. 50 years ago, in Incorporated Consultants versus Todd, at a time when we had code pleading, this very issue was before the court. In that case, a plaintiff who was an assignee sued on a note. The defendant contested that he owed the money to the plaintiff, lost, but did not appeal. He filed a post-judgment motion. The court in Incorporated Consultants said, you can't do that. It's too late. The judgment is not void, and an erroneous invocation of jurisdiction doesn't make the judgment void, again, because the court had jurisdiction over that type of dispute. Same situation here. I'm going to leave the first category and then go to the second category, cases in which the defendant shows up, defends, but says nothing about the issue of standing. That category should be governed by the same rule as the first. Res judicata attaches not only to arguments, claims, and defenses that were made, but those which could have been made. In every case in which a plaintiff seeks money, the plaintiff's standing is at issue. In every case where a trial court renders a judgment, the judgment at a minimum implicitly determines that it was the plaintiff that had the right to recover. If there's been an erroneous judgment that it wasn't the plaintiff that had the right to recover, the remedy is direct appeal. That should be, again, subject to res judicata. The most difficult question for the court is the third category, default judgments. you've got competing interests. On the one hand, you have the law's interest in protecting the finality of judgments. On the other, you have the law's interest in making sure that we get the correct judgment. For default judgments, that balance becomes much more difficult to achieve. I'm going to give you two examples. The first example, the defendant gets the complaint, looks at the complaint, and says, plaintiff doesn't have standing here, but I'm too busy to be bothered with a court action. 30 days goes by, the defendant gets the judgment, looks at the judgment, and says, there's no standing here, but I'm too busy to be bothered with an appeal. 2 years later, the defendant's not so busy anymore and files a motion to vacate. In that circumstance, the law's interest in the finality of judgments should preclude the belated challenge. Contrast that with a defendant who receives a complaint, is stricken with illness. 90 days later, he recovers, only to find that a default judgment's been rendered and the time for appeal has run. For that defendant, the law's interest in finality may not be so great. The American Law Institute doesn't take a firm position on this. In the second restatement of judgments, the American Law Institute notes that these types of cases normally are resolved through the regular channels of addressing motions for relief from judgment, in other words, 60B. In this case, the borrowers appeared, raised the issue of standing. That issue was the subject of a summary judgment motion. The borrowers lost. For these borrowers, they should have challenged that judgment through a direct appeal.
So we don't need to address the default question in this case. That'll be in the next case you bring to us.
Your Honor.
That comes up. No, I'm teasing. But the fact is, we don't have a default here, do we?
Botts actually was. The conflict
Pardon
case,
me?
Botts, the PNC Bank versus Botts, the 10th District case for which this is the conflict, was a default judgment.
Okay. So you're distinguishing the default situation from what we have in this case.
It becomes a much closer question. For the first two categories, you raised it or you at least appeared and didn't raise it, res judicata.
Well, is your argument then that there is not a conflict because Botts isn't on all fours with this?
There clearly is a conflict over the interpretation of Schwarzwald, Your Honor.
And what about the cases out of the 5th and the 11th?
The 5th and the 11th were both default judgments.
Both default.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. Both were the flip. Both were cases where they actually entered an appearance.
Okay, so
neither was a default.
Those
judgment.
Are closer factually to what we have before us than the case out of the 10th.
Correct, although the case out of the 10th and the opinion flat out says that standing cannot be challenged in a post-judgment motion, which is the exact opposite of what the 9th District says.
So what I'm hearing is that Schwarzwald is being interpreted as a jurisdictional case with the court perhaps lacking jurisdiction, but we all know the common pleas courts have jurisdiction over foreclosure matters. What Schwarzwald stands for is the litigant doesn't have a right to bring the case because the litigant doesn't own the note or the mortgage at the time of the filing. And unless or until that litigant has the proper necessary documentation, no case can be filed. That's what Schwarzwald says.
That is what Schwarzwald says, but these courts,
So we need perhaps to clarify what Schwarzwald stands for?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because what the District Courts of Appeal, the 9th, has interpreted Schwarzwald is saying lack of subject matter jurisdiction, that the trial court never had
never
subject
went that
matter
far
jurisdiction.
In Schwarzwald. I think we don't have subject matter jurisdiction referenced in there.
Actually, you never use the phrase subject matter jurisdiction.
Right.
You say six different times invoke the jurisdiction of the court.
Well, the fact is, it's really the right of the litigant to present the case.
Right.
And if a bank doesn't own a mortgage or have a mortgage or is a transferee or a holder in due course of a document, it doesn't have an injury, so it can't present a claim.
That's correct, Your Honor. And had this been a direct appeal, this would have been
the outcome.
That would have been the outcome. But this is now a different case.
This isn't that case. I understand your argument. Thank you very much.
Counsel, you had talked about the Bosch case, and you said it was a default case. And you had talked to us about the two different types of default, the first one where the defendant is too busy to do anything, the second one where there may have been a reason for failure to appeal. Which does Bosch fall into? Which category?
The 10th District said it didn't matter. The 10th District, with respect, may have gone too far. The 10th District said, you can't challenge this at all.
So that they would not have even allowed the second category.
Correct. And that's where the conflict is. Okay. The 10th District flat out says you can't do it at all, mm-hmm. while the 9th District takes the extreme opposite approach and makes it open season on the judgments.
And you're saying the ALI really is saying there's a possibility that could be opened up for the person in the second category.
Correct.
Thank
Counsel,
you.
Counsel, how would you deal with the case of the patent versus Deamer case from 1988, which I read to allow an appeal or allow a 60B, even where we might have otherwise, there might have been a void judgment?
In the patent case, Your Honor, there was a specific statutory grant of when one could get a cognovit judgment. And therefore, the court's decision was based upon when you could get a cognovit judgment. And so I think it's governed by the statute. That's how I would distinguish that case.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, 60B3 says the grounds for relief include fraud, misrepresentation, or misconduct of the adverse party. How does your client not fit into that?
The cases that have interpreted 60B3, Your Honor, have limited fraud misrepresentation to those representations that deprived the defendant of the ability to present a defense. There was no such deprivation here. The face of the complaint and its attachment is the grounds for this motion. So there was no fraud that would have deprived anyone of the opportunity to make the standing argument. Moreover, in this case, not only was there no fraud, the defendant recognized the issue and the answer.
Counsel, if we can stay with that, though, there was a misrepresentation, was there not, in the initial complaint?
I disagree with that, Your Honor. There was.
Did they call themselves the holder of the note?
They did, and the issue was whether...
Were they the holder of the note at that time?
The answer, Your Honor, is twofold. In this record, no, but outside of this record, yes. What was attached to the complaint was from the origination file. It didn't have the back of the note that had the endorsement on it.
But you will agree that's legally significant since the trial court dismissed this on a 60B for lack of standing to file the motion, correct?
Well, the trial court didn't. The trial court overruled the 60B.
Correct.
But the trial court overruled the motion, and overruled the motion, though, based upon the law that had existed in the Ninth District at the time. The trial court didn't care whether there had been an endorsement or not. It relied on the post-complaint assignment, which Schwarzwald makes clear is no longer a proper rationale, which is why, had this case been directly appealed...
Well, you said it was no longer a proper... wasn't ever, was it?
Eight of the 12...
It just got called... The financial institutions got called on it in Schwarzwald.
Your Honor, 8 of the 12 appellate districts had held that standing could be cured on post-complaint assignments. The court made clear that's no longer the law. But in the 9th District, it clearly was the law at the time. Any further questions? Your Honor, thank you very much. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Mr. Dan?
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court. My name is Mark Dan. I represent George and Bridget Kushta, the defendants in the underlying case, as well as the appellees here today. My partner, Grace Doberdruck, also represents the Kushtas, and amicus counsel, Andy Engel, is at the trial table with us as well. Your Honors, the certified question should be answered yes, because as this court found in Schwarzwald, standing is one component of determining justiciability that can be raised at any time, including on appeal. Even if there was no demonstration that the parties have, if there was no demonstration that the parties had an adverse interest, there was nothing for the court to hear at the time the complaint was filed. The record, and in fact, there was, Justice O'Neill, a misrepresentation in the complaint. The misrepresentation in the complaint alleged that the mortgage had been assigned to the plaintiff at the time of the filing of the complaint. It's right in the complaint. It's one of the allegations. It's also, interestingly, a determination was made by the trial court that all the allegations in the complaint were true. even though the record, as Mr. King admitted, does not contain any evidence whatsoever that at the time of the filing of the complaint that the plaintiff either held the note or had been assigned the mortgage in the case. They had literally no dispute, no adverse claim with the Kushtas at all.
Counsel, though, what about the argument that we've heard this morning that has some weight that, okay, this was a bad lawsuit, shouldn't have been filed, there was no jurisdiction, and then you don't appeal?
Well, Your Honor, I think that there's a middle course that this court can take, can approach this issue with. And I think the courts, I agree with Mr. King, that the lower courts in the state need some guidance in this regard. And that is this: if the issue of jurisdiction is directly raised and fully and fairly litigated, I think the restatement of judgments, as cited by Mr. King, goes on after the parts he cites in his brief to say that if that's not been done in the trial court, if it's not been done in the Court of Appeals, that the issue of jurisdiction is available to be raised at any point.
Counsel, when you say that it should be fully and fairly litigated,
yes,
we did have a summary judgment here. I mean, the bank did file a motion for summary judgment. There was no contrary evidence on that issue. So why does that not constitute full and fair litigation of the issue?
Well, and I think in the best Justice French, in the best characterization, this case fits into the third category that Mr. King was talking about, because here's what happened. In the answer, the Kushtas downloaded an answer from the legal aid website. And all they wrote in their answer that they're relying on to say that the defense of jurisdiction was raised, is that my original mortgage was with Wells Fargo Mortgage Company. This is not the plaintiff. There is no proof in the no proof. Of course, we know that proof doesn't need to be proof in the complaint. No proof in the foreclosure complaint that the plaintiff owns or was assigned my mortgage. Then, in the motion for summary judgment that you refer to, the plaintiff argues that the defense raised was not sufficient to put the plaintiff on notice of any defense or any denial or any affirmative defense. They say that directly. It's in the record. They say it directly. Then we have an affidavit in support of the motion for summary judgment that verifies, first of all, says only a broad declaration that the plaintiff is the holder of the note, which is a legal conclusion. And it attaches to it a note and verifies that it was that attached to the affidavit was a true and accurate copy of the exact same copy of the note that was filed with the complaint. And the note that was filed with the complaint was payable to Wells Fargo, not to Bank of America. There's simply, even at the time, the summary judgment issue, and there's no discussion in the complaint. And I think it's important, Justice French, to understand how these cases are litigated at the granular level. The record will show that a judgment entry was circulated by the plaintiff and prepared by the plaintiff and unaltered by the trial court at the time that judgment entry was ultimately entered. It was submitted to the plaintiffs and submitted for review to the parties on August 6th. The motion for summary judgment in this case wasn't even filed until August 10th. There was no information in front of the parties at the time that the judgment entry was circulated. And then the judge, almost a year later, simply signed that judgment entry in the form that it was prepared by the counsel for the plaintiff.
Counsel, your clients were pro se, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Up until what point?
They were pro se until subsequent to the appeal. They came to us when the appeal period had run. The matter had been set for a sheriff's sale, and they retained us. And at that point, we immediately accessed the court within a few months of the judgment.
All right. Did they attempt to secure legal representation, or did they start out from the get-go being their own representation?
As many people in financial distress do, my clients were unable to retain counsel when the case was filed.
When you say unable, did they attempt to?
They had contacted legal aid. That's how they came up with this form answer that was filed. And at the time, there was a mediation program going on in the Medina County courts, mm-hmm. and they were continually enticed by a promise by Wells Fargo, by the way, who was servicing the loan. So adding to the confusion here, Even though Bank of America is the plaintiff, the servicer of the loan is Wells Fargo. That's the one and only group of people that my clients have been dealing with all the way through.
Well, what do you mean they were enticed to enter into mediation?
They were enticed not to defend by a promise that they would be carefully and appropriately considered for a loan modification. If you recall at the time, that's what the banks were telling.
Well, there was also the Save the Dream program.
Right.
That this court was, you know, a proponent of at
well,
the
well
time.
Aware,
did they take advantage of that?
They applied for assistance through the mediation program. They applied for whatever assistance was available to them. But there was a clear confidence at the time that the answer was due that by filing this would keep the case open in court and allow them the chance on the promise to work this out. Now, there's no information in the record because settlement negotiations are clearly wouldn't be or are not admissible, and it's not a defense, but on a practical level, the Kushtas were like many, many other litigants in these cases, kind of lulled into a sense of security that there was a party working with them to try to resolve the case.
Do you have documentation as to that?
It's not in the record, Your Honor, but there was an extensive negotiation back and forth between the Kushtas and Wells Fargo, an exchange of documents multiple times. And this is not an unfamiliar story. This happens in almost every foreclosure case where the homeowner doesn't sit on their rights.
Mr. Dan, on page 2 of your brief, you say the appellant, Bank of America, filed a complaint in foreclosure against the appellees and falsely alleged that it was the holder of the note.
That's correct. That's exactly what happened. And not only did they falsely allege that they were the holder, they falsely alleged that the note had been assigned to them. Their own evidence presented in the record demonstrates that they had not been assigned the note at the day that the complaint was filed. And this court, look, this factually, this case, and I think Mr. King has acknowledged this, is on all fours with Schwarzwald. No note, no mortgage at the time of filing. This court has been very clear historically that you cannot waive the issue of subject matter jurisdiction. And while we can have a lot of conversations about what type of jurisdiction this is, I think this court should look at it this way. Subject matter jurisdiction is a constitutional or statutory authority to decide a case. You can't get to the statutory grant. You can't get to the fact that common pleas courts, Justice O'Donnell, have the right to hear foreclosure cases until you get past the justiciable matter that's clearly in Article 4 of the Constitution. This court has been very clear on what that means. Most recently in Kincaid versus Erie Insurance where there has to be an actual adverse relationship between the parties, and there has to be a remedy that the court can provide. Otherwise, we have the people taking advantage of the court for advisory opinions or for opinions that are not, or the court hearing matters, as Justice O'Donnell suggested, where he would sue on a note due to Justice Pfeiffer and have no standing to do so.
So, Mr. Dan, you would have us say that standing is part of subject matter jurisdiction? That essentially would open everything up for collateral attack. It would weaken res judicata. We've seen this happen in the criminal side. Mm-hmm. And you would want us to go to the same situation, saying that if a person doesn't have standing to sue, then anything the court does after that is void and subject to collateral attack at any time.
Unless the issue of jurisdiction has been directly raised and fully and fairly litigated. So I would amend that because I think that would prevent that flood of litigation that you're concerned about. And that's what we're suggesting here. If the Kushtas, as Mr. King has admitted, if the Kushtas had directly raised the issue of jurisdiction and the matter had been fully and fairly litigated, then either the trial court would have found differently, it would have been found differently on appeal, or this court would have addressed it at the time they addressed the Schwarzwald matter.
So putting it in an answer is not raising it, in your view.
Well, here's what's in the answer is very, very vague and very factual and not a legal defense or an affirmative defense constituted as any lawyer would ever.
So you're going to equate it with a default?
I think this is very much like the Botts case.
All right,
very much
you want to equate it with a default and say that under your scenario, what you would like to see this court say, that it was that the justiciability of this case was never determined initially.
Right. It was never directly raised and fully and fairly litigated. I think you can say that about both the Botts case, the conflict case, as well as
how many foreclosure cases have been disposed of on default in this state?
Oh, probably tens of thousands, if not more.
And under your scenario, they're all subject to be reopened.
They're all subject to be reopened to the extent that the issue of the jurisdiction, because Article 4.
The issue of jurisdiction is an issue.
Correct.
That's what you would have then. I mean, I can just envision thousands of default judgments in foreclosure cases being combed through over by attorneys looking for that connection between the standing of the plaintiff and the holder of the note.
Your Honor, as important as the finality of judgments is, so too, and probably, and I would argue more important, is the validity of judgments. The Constitution of this state clearly states that there must be a judiciable controversy, and the case law.
Well, that's what we said in Schwarzwald.
Correct.
We said if you aren't the holder of the note, you don't have the right to bring the claim.
Correct.
Now, that has morphed into, I'm hearing today, all courts around the state say, well, there's no subject matter jurisdiction of a court to hear a foreclosure case. That isn't anything at all what we said in Schwarzwald.
And that's, Your Honor, that's not what I'm advocating.
It's being transcended into something that it doesn't say. Now, maybe we reference jurisdiction, and I don't doubt Mr. King when he counts six times that we've said jurisdiction of the court, but the fact is, it's the right of the litigant to present a claim. And if you don't have an injury, you don't have a right to present that claim because you don't have standing before the court. Now, I think, as I look at the facts that you've presented here, your clients are on all fours with Schwarzwald. But as Mr. King argues to us, this isn't a Schwarzwald case at all. This is a 60B case, and we didn't deal with that in Schwarzwald. So can you address for me the argument that Mr. King is raising, that this is res judicata, and why it shouldn't be res judicata?
Yes. Even the restatement of judgments says, judgment that was rendered by a court lacking the capability to make an adequately informed decision, determination of a question concerning its own jurisdiction, and as a matter of procedural fairness, the party seeking to avoid the judgment should have the opportunity belatedly to attack the court's subject matter jurisdiction. In this case, this is the Kushta case, the Botts case are perfect examples of that.
So your time is getting short, Mr. You suggested to us earlier, I think, that you think we need to provide some guidance to trial courts.
Yes, sir.
So what is it that you want us to give? What guidance do they need, or what clarification do we have for Schwarzwald, or how do we address that and get that message out to them?
That res judicata, there are situations where res judicata would apply to subject matter jurisdiction or to this constitutional grant of jurisdiction,
okay,
but only if the issue has been directly raised and fully and fairly litigated. So, and the issue where there's a default to the complaint, it wouldn't have been directly raised and fully
so
and fairly
we need
litigated.
To address the question of whether or not standing was raised by your client saying, I don't have any dealings whatsoever with the Bank of America. And we have to look at that and figure out what that means.
Actually, the constitutional grant of jurisdiction is the power of the court. It's not a right of the litigant. That's why under Hurley
versus
Pratt's, we use
the term jurisdiction in Schwarzwald. And so it's obviously morphed into something more than we addressed, because we are exactly what you're arguing. It's a constitutional precept, which we articulated in Schwarzwald and is now gotten downfield.
Unless the court has directly reviewed its own power to hear the case and thought about it and actually had some information about it, then I think a litigant is well within their rights to ask the court to review whether it had the power to grant the judgment.
So you would have collateral attacks on default judgments in mortgage foreclosure cases?
Only if the issue has not been directly raised and fully and fairly
litigated. In a situation that you have here, it sounds like there could be many, many cases. What do you do with the people who have potentially bought these homes in good faith, thinking they have clear title,
Well, that's
the idea of collateral attacking these cases at any point outside of the direct appeal period is what is concerning me.
Justice Landrieu, that's the good news, because the legislature is ahead of us on this. They've enacted 2329.45 and 2329.46, which provides that a house sold at sheriff sale, that the subsequent purchaser is protected. The remedy, if any, would be for some sort of restitution from the lender. And remember, the person that sued and without having an adverse controversy at all with the defendant would be the person that the only entity that would potentially be on the hook here. But the homeowners, the subsequent purchasing homeowners, this would not throw the real estate markets of the state into chaos. In fact, the legislature's already provided for that. What this would do, though, is allow people who have been lulled into a sense of security trying to modify their loans in the way that the Kushtas were, or the Botzes were, for that matter, because we represented them in the case below as well, into not actively defending, not directly raising this issue, and the court, more importantly, not exercising its required duty to determine whether it had the power to hear the case.
Mr. Dan, how do you see this all unwinding in your view of a perfect world, which would be you prevail and you have all these default judgments out there, and certainly the financial institutions are unsympathetic. They packaged these and sold them in a sloppy fashion and overrated what was being sold and all of that. But for the parties who had default judgments or didn't contest or in the category that you're talking about, what's the damage? Because they were behind to somebody. I mean, somebody advanced the funds to purchase the home or for a home equity loan, and they were in default.
Justice Pfeiffer, let's consider the consequences for other cases. Is it reasonable that when you leave here today that you file a lawsuit against Justice O'Donnell and hope that he rear-ends you on 71 on your way home so that you'll have a justiciable controversy by the time you get to trial? Is it fair that MasterCard sues you for a debt you owe Visa, supported by an affidavit that's signed by American Express? I think that it's easy to think about these foreclosure cases as some sort of a second-class legal citizen.
Okay, but once we bring all this to the courthouse, what's the damage?
Well, the damage is the right to fully and fairly litigate the claim. First of all, there are all kinds of issues that can be raised as to the accounting on a mortgage loan, as to whether or not
the bottom line is what does the plaintiff get at the end of the day if they attack and there is shown that the lack of standing on your default scenario, because that's what we're talking about.
They get the protection that the framers of Article 4 of the Ohio Constitution intended them to get, which was not to be able to be sued by somebody with whom they don't have a dispute.
Is there the availability for damages against the lending institution?
I think that's something that would have to develop, but there certainly isn't the ability to attack the subsequent purchasers of the home. So that's not an issue. If it's all the sheriff's sale, that's not what the goal is. The goal is here, these people have been...
Well, I understand that, Mr. Dan. The point of my question is, there are a lot of these out there. A lot.
Right.
And the financial institutions are unsympathetic. But if you get to where you're pointing, is it a punitive damage kind of thing? What are we talking about?
I mean, I don't know that the court, because
all this litigation ties up the court's resources, and yes, I'm a strong advocate of the courthouse doors being open, but there has to be some point to it at the end.
I agree. First of all, I'm not sure there'd be money damage. As you pointed out, somebody's in default on a mortgage. The money damages may not be very much at all. What is at stake here is a much more important principle, and the principle is that this can be applied not just in the foreclosure context, but across the board. We're seeing debt buyer, and I saw there was one that argued a couple of weeks ago here. There's some debt buyer cases that are starting to crop up where people don't have any relationship with the person they're suing, collecting damages, and most folks sitting at home receiving a complaint by certified mail think, well, I owe somebody. And yet there are defenses that can be raised. There is the courts in the state of Ohio are a precious institution, and they ought to be reserved for people
who actually have an appeal. That's why we have the appeal process, Mr. Dan.
I agree, Your Honor. If in fact there's an actual determination on the merits of the issue, which in it's simply been what would happen if you ruled in Mr. And found that there you can never, which because remember the certified question, Justice Landiger, is this: can you ever bring a post-judgment motion for relief from judgment on the issue of constitutional jurisdiction on the Schwarzwald issue? And the answer has to be yes. There are circumstances where that can be. Whether that's narrow or broad, I think is fair subject for review and determination. But in a default judgment, when the issue was never raised and the court never considered its own jurisdiction, and where judgments are being carried into the courthouse, I mean here it is. A form judgment that was prepared by plaintiff's counsel before the motion for summary judgment was filed.
Counsel,
signed by the judge without any alterations.
I got to ask you about that. I know we're out of time, but the problem, and I think that Justice Pfeiffer is raising and I raise as well, this is a 60B case. By your theory, is there no temporal limitation on when a 60B can be filed? For example, by your theory, if someone received a default judgment 10 years ago, may they file a 60B tomorrow?
The rule 60B provides statutory and civil rule limitations on when motions for relief can be filed, and I believe that a litigant would have to comply with those in order to be successful. There's also been recognized in the state when it relates to constitutional jurisdiction, the concept of a common law motion to vacate as well, which preceded the civil rules, and is still valid law in the state of Ohio. And at the end of the day, Justice O'Neill, I don't think it matters whether you get to that determination in a Chevy or in a Ford, that the court has a duty when brought to its attention that it perhaps exercised its jurisdiction outside of the constitutional grant of authority, that they have to take a look at that question and make that determination. Now, if they decide that that the litigant's wrong, then they have to appeal. Once it's directly raised and fully and fairly litigated, then and only then should res judicata apply.
Thank you.
Thanks, Your Honor.
Mr. King, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
I will be brief, Your Honor. This fully and fairly litigated notion would encourage defendants to keep this defense in their back pocket. They would know they could always come back and set aside the judgment. That can't be the law. That would encourage the inefficient use of judicial resources. Standing is not the same as subject matter jurisdiction. Standing is a separate jurisdictional requirement. If it were a subject matter jurisdictional issue, Justice O'Neill, a common law motion to vacate would be filed 20 years from now. There has to be a limit on when judgments can be challenged.
What guidance do we provide to trial courts when we write this opinion, regardless of what we come out? What do we tell them?
Your Honor, I would suggest that you would adopt the first proposition of law which we had, which is res judicata bars the defendant who participated in litigation from using a post-judgment motion to contest standing.
Mr. Dan argues that the response that was apparently downloaded and filed is not sufficient to raise the standing question.
I have a couple things to say about that, Your
Honor.
That's
why I asked you.
Number one, it was raised in the answer. Number two, it was directly the subject of the summary judgment motion.
It was
directly the subject because they argued the post-complaint assignment was sufficient.
Okay.
These borrowers were represented by counsel prior to Mr. Dan. That counsel withdrew, and once that counsel withdrew, Mr. Dan then entered an appearance. And while he said that this was downloaded off Legal Aid, Your Honor, this property at sale was appraised at $1.2 million. All things, Your Honor, including litigation, have to have an end.
Thank you.
And so do arguments.
That's a perfect ending for me. Thank you, Your Honor.
Marshall, will you call a recess, please?
All rise. Well stated.